Hello, I'm Ted Bird. This is number 0395, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0395. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Anthony Del Call is back on the program. He has a new comic book out that puts the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew in a modern-day noir drama. It's an idea that came to him 2 years ago.
After Life with Archie, the amazing Archie series, where they pitted all the characters from Riverdale into a Walking Dead type story. And I loved the fact that they were able to take these well-known characters and pluck them into a completely new scenario, and in doing so, shed new lights onto them. And so I started to look around and thought, well, what other characters from my youth that might be interesting for this? And after a brief little search, I mean, Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys came up, and I thought, what? Yeah, that would be amazing. And for some reason, the idea of putting them into a hard-boiled noir detective story, so if they're completely out of their elements, it came naturally to me.
Israel Smith from NPR, the man behind the podcast campaign with the hashtag TryPod.
There was a meeting late last year in New York amongst some of the bigger podcast publishers, and we were talking about how fast podcasts have been growing and how much the audience really loves them, and how we're doing our best to invite more and more people into the wonderful world of podcasting. And we started to talk about how we could actually make the podcast audience even bigger. How could we help even more people discover the incredible range of content that's available?
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter takes a tasty look at the life of the founder, Ray Kroc, the man behind McDonald's Golden Arches, with his memoir, Grinding It Out. So you deserve a break today, and it's coming soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0395 was Ted Bird, the legendary broadcaster who is the morning man at The Jewel FM. You can check out their site at jewel1067.com. And thank you very much, Ted, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Ted's always been a stand-up guy. Nice to have you on the program to do the slate. Thank you very much. Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. The Stuff File program, a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Be a patron of the show and find out about our rewards program. I'd also love to hear your thoughts about the Stuff File program and even some of your ideas for rewards. So come on, participate, and join us for the ride. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Be part of the Stuff File Nation. Well, let's get right to the Stuff File news, shall we? A woman dropped her daughter off at school in Lakeland, Florida, and then noticed a man in a pickup truck was following her. She wasn't imagining it. The man rammed her car with his truck and kept after her. Then it got weird. "He gets out of his truck, walks up to my door, and I roll down my window a bit," says 35-year-old Christina Fuller. Why she rolled down the window, I'll never know. Anyway, "he threw his dog through the window, a miniature pincher. Afraid the dog was trained to bite, she tossed it back. He gets back into his truck and starts hitting my truck from behind. She knew there was a cop back at the school, so she turned back toward there and called ahead so they would be ready. I didn't even think to call 911. I was so scared. When she arrived, she ran inside, grabbed the officer, and they came back outside. Said Fuller, "we found the guy trying to get into my truck." 41-year-old Howard Van Swearingen told the officer he thought Fuller was pretty and wanted to, quote, "talk to her at any cost," unquote. Okay. So, now the prosecutor's job making sure that cost is very, very high. Suddenly, online dating makes much more sense, doesn't it? 36-year-old Nevada Transportation Authority Supervisor Robert Reasoner was arrested in Carson City after allegedly arranging to buy heroin from an informant. This arrest is different from the previous charges he's had. 2 DUI convictions, plus he pleaded guilty to a lesser reckless driving charge after another alleged DUI incident. He was also out on bail after an incident where he allegedly drove under the influence and fled the scene of his crashed state-owned vehicle. Because civil service protections prevent Reasoner from being fired without a hearing, he was placed on paid administrative leave pending an investigation. "He's kind of spiraling out of control," said Carson City District Attorney Jason Woodbury. You know, to spiral out of control, you first have to be in control. Remember, he's an authority on transportation. What does that tell you about the department? And still with public officials, Stephen Reed, the former mayor of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, pleaded guilty on the eve of his January trial on corruption counts stemming from the approximately 10,000 items of Wild West and Americana artifacts worth about $8 million that he bought in public funds during 28 years in office. For some reason, he had a single-minded obsession with creating a local All Things Cowboy Museum, and had purchased such items as a stagecoach, stagecoach harnesses, a Billy the Kid wanted poster, a wagon wheel, and a totem pole. Somehow, he explained, as he was leaving office after being voted out in 2009, the items he had purchased, theoretically on behalf of Harrisburg, had migrated into his personal belongings. You know, in Western days, they used to wear handkerchiefs over the lower part of their faces when robbing banks and stagecoaches. I wonder how many of those Stephen Reed has. Just asking. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Florida Keys authorities say a drunken man from Rhode Island stole a forklift and crashed into a gate, telling deputies he lost his car keys and needed something to drive. The Monroe County Sheriff's Office says in a news release that 44-year-old Edward Quinton of Greenwich, Rhode Island, told deputies that he was in the Keys helping friends move. Quinton was quoted as saying that after he lost his keys Thursday night, he needed a vehicle and took the forklift from a Marathon marina because he knew how to drive one. Quinton also told deputies he thought he could fix the damaged gate. Breath tests showed Quinton's blood alcohol level was twice Florida's legal limit. He faces drunk driving, criminal mischief, burglary, and grand theft charges. On the bright side, he did come a long way to help a friend move. You know, those kind-hearted people are often very hard to find. I'm guessing even harder now. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Comic book creator Anthony Del Call is back on the program. You may remember he was a co-creator of Kill Shakespeare, which was initially a 12-part comic book series featuring Shakespeare's most famous heroes. He also had a hand in the series called Assassin's Creed, which dove into the Salem witch trials of 1692. Well now, Anthony has put his spin on the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew with a fresh look at the characters in Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, The Big Lie. Anthony joins us on the line via Skype from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Anthony.
Brooklyn's in the house.
Well, you know, you're right in my wheelhouse here. I mean, I grew up a major, major Hardy Boys fan when I was a kid. So how did you come to getting your hands on the opportunity to send the Hardy Boys into a new situation?
I guess I'm not your typical comic writer who kind of sits waiting by, I guess, his laptop waiting for an email for writing gigs. The nugget started about 2 years ago after I read Afterlife with Archie, the amazing Archie series, where, you know, they pitted all the characters from Riverdale into a Walking Dead type story. And I loved the fact that they were able to take these well-known characters and pluck them into a completely new scenario, and in doing so, shed new lights onto them. And so I started to look around and thought, well, what other characters from my youth that I read when I was younger that might be interesting for this? And after a brief little search, I mean, Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys came up, and I thought, yeah, that would be amazing. And for some reason, the idea of putting them into a hard-boiled noir detective story, so if they're completely out of their elements, it came naturally to me. And so I went out, looked for the license, spoke to Laura Becker, the licensing agent, and it turned out that, lo and behold, the rights were about to become available. Put together my pitch, pitched her on the idea, as well as Simon & Schuster, the rights holders. And then we went out and pitched it to all the different publishing companies, and Dynamite was the first one that stepped up, and they loved it the most, so we said, well, let's go with them.
Okay, now, as you mentioned, and we talked about before, you are a comic book creator to a certain degree, so you're doing this in comic book form, which is not the way the Hardy Boys were originally, correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, and you had to go to the rights holders of these stories, of this whole canon of work. When you made your pitch, and I don't want to give anything away here, I don't know what's a spoiler or not, but when you did your pitch, did you mention in your pitch that the plot line for the story?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we didn't have a title per se, but no, I had the concept of a very simple story, and you know, I'm not spoiling anything by saying that it starts out with Frank and Joe Hardy, the two brothers, of course, the Hardy Boys, in separate interrogation rooms, and they're being interrogated for the murder of their detective father. So I pitched them that idea, and then I also pitched them the idea that in order to clear their names and prove that they're innocent, they would have to turn to a femme fatale known as Nancy Drew. So it was that sort of concept. And then I talked about, you know, in the actual pitch, it was a very short pitch, you know, what would happen. I mean, the whole series hinges on the fact that the three of them now have to delve into the seedy underbelly of their small town, Bayport, which is like a New England style town. And so, yeah, I pitched in that general concept. I said, well, look, I mean, I also want to integrate other characters from the Stratemeyer Syndicate. So not only Nancy Drew and the two brothers, but also the Bobbsey twins, the Rover boys, Tom Swift. These are all characters that were created by Edward Stratemeyer years and years ago. And in fact, I think this is the 90th anniversary of the first printing of Hardy Boys. So yeah, I told him I wanted to integrate all these characters, and I think it was a bold new concept, and it hadn't been done before. And so the, you know, the rights holders and the licensing company, I think they really liked this take on it and realized that this would be a new way of introducing the character or reintroducing the character to new readers.
Well, bold is an understatement, because you know, I didn't want to give anything away, but you touched on the plot line of the story. And as again, I grew up reading these books. I couldn't wait for a new Hardy Boy book to come out when I was a kid. So when I was reading over this information and the fact that you've, first of all, killed off Fenton Hardy, I gasped.
Yes, it was. There are a couple things I've changed to it, or you know that I've amended in order to suit the story. I mean, one, yes, Fenton Hardy is dead at the very beginning. I mean, the very first scene is Frank and Joe in the interrogation rooms. It was the first image that came to mind when I first thought of the concept. So yeah, I mean, we have to play with that. And also we're playing with the fact that, I mean, the two brothers are not getting along. I mean, in the books, they're best friends, they get into adventures together, and instead, in this case, they start off as almost enemies. And I mean, as the story goes on, as the first issue goes on, and then as the story goes on over the six issues, we're going to find out what exactly tore them apart, and then whether they can be brought back together again.
And there's also a question about their integrity in connection to the integrity of their father's legacy, too.
Absolutely. So in this case here, Fenton Hardy was a police detective. But what happened was he, 6 months prior to, you know, to where we start off, 6 months earlier, we've discovered that he has been, outed as a crooked cop, basically. So, I mean, he's been doing some shady dealings with the underworld. And so this has been brought to life. So he's disgraced. So the boys are embarrassed. Fenton's embarrassed. His wife's embarrassed. Everyone thinks they're criminals. No one wants to talk to them. The kids lose their girlfriends, their jobs, all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, it's just a really, really bad time for them. And then with a month to go before the trial, and of course, the trial is being overseen by federal prosecutor Carson Drew, who is the father of Nancy Drew. He's found dead with a suicide note, apparently a suicide, but then they start to believe that it's more than just that, and then it gets around to the brother. So, is the integrity of Fenton Hardy question, but also now the two brothers, because they're attached to him. And so what's really interesting to me overall in the story, and I know I'm getting ahead of myself and I apologize for that, is the concept of here are three characters, Joe, Frank, and Nancy, who are predominantly known as very squeaky clean characters, and like very goody-goody, and now they have to delve into this underworld. And they're almost taking on these personas of criminals or of thugs. Can they survive that way? And more importantly, can they exist in that sort of can they survive with these masks that they're putting on?
Now, it takes place in modern times. It's updated. It's today. It's current, right?
Absolutely. It's 2017, Bayport, which is, like I said, a New England town. It's one of those coastal areas where the tourists come in every summer, you know, sort of like loosely based on, say, Portland, Maine or Montauk. You know, the tourists come in, you know, in the off season, it's very quiet. But then as soon as the weather starts to get nice, the tourists come for lobster fishing, for hanging out by the lake, to their nice cottages and their homes and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we find out that the tourists are not just there for clean, squeaky clean fun, but also for perhaps some criminal fun too.
Well, I bring up the modern aspect of it because, as again, like you said twice now, there is a squeaky clean image that the Hardy Boys had and Nancy Drew had. And I'm just wondering, is it even possible in 2017 to be squeaky clean? Is that era, is that just gone?
It's a good question. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to do it in modern day and also as a noir was because when you think of Frank, Joe, and Nancy, you mainly think of them as those squeaky clean characters, and you think small town USA, you know, like the good old days, you know, say 1950s era, that sort of thing, even though they work great in the 20s and the 30s. And so I wanted to play with that, and it's a very good question, and it's something that we do discuss, like how squeaky clean can a person be? And one of the more interesting things is, especially in today's modern society, when you look at teenagers, I mean, they have so many masks, I guess, or they have so many personas. I mean, one is the persona that they have with their parents or with adults, you know, or teachers. You know, then they have a persona that they have with their friends. Then they have personas on social media in terms of Snapchat or Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. And, you know, they even have multiple accounts on these different social media. So what's really interesting to me about this modern day element is, are we the same in every single environment that we find ourselves in?
You mentioned six entities, six chapters, right? Six.
It's initially released as six individual issues, but I mean, we'd love to. I've scoped it out as an ongoing series, so depending on how sales are, which thus far has been quite strong, as well as critical reaction, which again has been very strong. I'd love to continue this on to a second arc, a third arc, a fourth arc. So, you know, have this run for 12, 18, 20, 24 issues.
And how do people get their hands on it?
Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, The Big Lie Number 1, is available at comic shops today. It was just released last week, so it's available any single comic book shop across North America and the world, as well as available on Comixology or any other digital comics provider.
Excellent. Anthony, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Continued success with all you do.
Thank you very much.
Anthony Del Call, one of the creators of the Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, The Big Lie comic book. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is number 0395, and you'll find links to Anthony's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the comic book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Inform or entertain? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about a month-long campaign for podcast awareness. Plus, we do indeed have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nelman. He'll be along a little later on. And we also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way. Plus, much more Stuff File news right here, right now. On a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, police say a couple in Ohio staged a murder scene in a bathtub in which they poured ketchup all over her, and then he then sent pictures to friends saying he did it. Sandusky officers showed up after getting calls from three people police say were hysterical. That's when officers discovered that the scene in the couple's bathtub had been staged. Police say Natalie Schlett and Micah Reisner were charged with inducing panic. Both pleaded not guilty. Police Sergeant Don Allen says that while it might be funny to a couple, it wasn't a joke to police. You know, all the pranks that were oh so funny back in the day just don't seem to fly in the world of social media, do they? Yeah. We get information out there to a lot of people. And also, at the same time, globally, people have lost a sense of humor a bit. Interesting dichotomy. Anyway, a Georgia teenager decided to take a rest after a leisurely afternoon walk by draping his legs over some railroad tracks, putting on his headphones, and closing his eyes. The results are just as bad as you might expect. He was struck by a train, and both legs have been lost. Officer Andy Blimline, who was the first on the scene, said that he found 17-year-old Jacob Ohl conscious despite his severe injuries. Blimline said that he soon realized that the teen's legs were no longer attached to his body. Ohl was rushed to a hospital, but doctors were unable to reattach his limbs. The teenager told police that he did not intend to hurt himself when he sat down on the tracks. Ohl is a senior in high school and plays for a school orchestra jazz band. His instrument is stand-up bass. Well, not anymore. I don't want to make light of this story, but I do have one question. As Jacob goes through life, meeting new people and constantly retelling the story of how he lost his legs, what percentage of folks hearing the tale will attempt to stifle any facial expressions that will betray a sense of incredulousness or laughter? Oh, methinks that number might be high. Okay, while we're still dealing with tracks, a woman decided to head from Brooklyn toward Manhattan on New York's J train subway line without the benefit of a train. At 8:55 a.m., she jumped from the Myrtle Avenue platform and started walking on the track, checking her phone and chatting with concerned commuters. She hadn't covered much distance when police caught up to her and took her to a hospital for a psychiatric evaluation. In other words, a checkup from the neck up. You know, you can say a lot about New York's public transit system, but the one thing you can't say is it isn't plentiful and it runs like clockwork. I mean, just listen to Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, when he's on. He always touts how well the New York subway and transit system works, and he's absolutely correct. If you're that impatient with New York mass transit, you must be crazy, or you just have never lived elsewhere. That's all I'm saying. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Miami defense attorney is feeling the heat after his pants caught fire after he told jurors during arguments in an arson case that his client's car spontaneously combusted and wasn't intentionally set. As he started speaking to the jury, 28-year-old Steven Gutierrez said he noticed his pocket began to feel hot. When I checked my pocket, I noticed that the heat was coming from a small e-cigarette battery I had in my pocket. He said he had two or three of the batteries in his right pocket. The Miami Herald reported Gutierrez was arguing that his client's car spontaneously combusted and wasn't intentionally set on fire. Gutierrez said he quickly left the courtroom and went to a courthouse bathroom. I was able to toss the battery in water after it singed my pocket open, he said. Gutierrez said the incident was not staged. No one thinks that a battery left in their pocket is somehow going to explode, he wrote. The lawyer ran out of the courtroom, and the judge also had the jurors taken to the jury room. When Gutierrez returned to the courtroom unharmed, he insisted it wasn't a staged defense gone wrong. Later in the day, his client, 48-year-old Claudie Charles, was convicted of second-degree arson. Prosecutors and the Miami-Dade police are investigating this current incident. Investigators seized frayed e-cigarette batteries as evidence. Miami-Dade Circuit Judge Michael Hansman also could decide to hold Gutierrez in contempt of court. Gutierrez told the AP that he researched e-cigarette batteries and learned that they can be extremely dangerous. The dangers of those devices and accessories have led me to quit using e-cigarette products, he wrote. Well, that's nice. Well, Stephen, the judge is considering contempt charges. I'm guessing he came to that conclusion based on the second part of a standard equation. You know, pants on fire? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? This month of March features an awareness campaign to encourage folks to spread the word about the podcasts they listen to. People are asked to promote the shows they like using the hashtag TryPod. That's TryPod. It's a classic tell-a-friend word-of-mouth campaign. To talk a little bit about it, we're joined by Israel Smith, who is the Senior Director of Promotion and Audience Development at NPR. He joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Hi, Izzy.
Good afternoon, Peter. Thanks so much for taking time to chat.
Thanks for taking the time to chat with us. You are the guys who are basically behind this whole thing, which is growing like wildfire amongst the podcast community. How did this idea come about in the first place?
Well, it came about very organically and has really been a group effort from the very beginning, Peter. There was a meeting late last year in New York amongst some of the bigger podcast publishers, and we were talking about how fast podcasts have been growing and how much the audience really loves them. And how we're doing our best to invite more and more people into the wonderful world of podcasting. And we started to talk about how we could actually make the podcast audience even bigger. How could we help even more people discover the incredible range of content that's available through podcasts? And I threw out this idea for, as you said, a classic tell a friend campaign where we could all perhaps collaborate over the course of a month and work together, even though the industry is filled, as any industry is, with very active competitors. We could work together on this on behalf of the audience. And I was very pleased with the reaction in the room from folks at that meeting. And it's just kind of grown organically since then. And ever since we announced it about 2 weeks ago, more and more and more people have just jumped on to the train and helped to spread the word. And now, as you say, the hashtag TryPod, tripod, is something that I have now lost my ability to keep up with. It seems like there's at least two or three new recommendations that pop up every couple of seconds. It's quite remarkable.
Wow. The thing that's kind of interesting is, as you say, the podcast audience is growing quite a bit. But conversely, which is one of the reasons I guess you're getting the word out, there's a lot of people who don't know anything about podcasts or what they even are.
Well, that's right. So two of the challenges we hope the Tripod Project will help solve is this idea of podcast discovery. There's so much out there. I think the latest number I've heard from Apple is that there's some 350,000 podcasts available on the iTunes store, and trying to find something that you're really going to love is a bit of a challenge. So no better way to address that than getting referrals from your friends and people you have relationships with, either real or virtual, on social media to help you really crack the code and find something that you'll really fall in love with. And the other thing is straight up technological. There are still people who aren't quite sure where on their phones, and most podcasts now are consumed on mobile devices, they can find a podcast. So part of our mission for Tripod is to have friends show friends how to find that podcast app, that little purple app on their iPhone, or how to use the Google Play application on their Android device to listen to podcasts. In fact, just today, my friends across town here in Washington, D.C. at the Diane Rehm Show just posted a brand new instructional video called Diane Learns How to Listen to a Podcast to YouTube, which is designed to show people exactly how to unravel this great mystery, which, as you know, Peter, is really not that much of a mystery at all.
Well, you know, again, with the thousands of podcasts that's out there, there is a varying range of the size and scope that these podcasts and subject matters that these podcasts have to offer. And that size and range also runs the gamut from the guy who's doing the podcast in his garage to large broadcasting entities like NPR. How is it to get the big guns to go along with all this? As you said earlier, a lot of these people are competing with each other.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, that, I think, has been the biggest, most delightful surprise in this work, beyond the incredible response from the audience, which we expected to have fun with this, but not at the scale that seems to be happening and with the passion that people are really putting into this. On the participant side, again, it was really a matter of saying, you know, we have the beauty of podcasts are some of the most compelling and interesting personalities on the planet are putting their hearts and souls into making these programs every week, whether that's large-scale things like what we do at NPR or small, deeply personal things that are designed for a very, very specific niche audience. People connect with them. They feel like they're part of a really close-knit group that listens to these things. They feel like it's theirs. And it was the opportunity to work together and tap into that passion that I think got everyone excited initially to give this a go and work together. And at the end of the day, if it works, we hope that the outcome will be all boats rise with the tide, and we all see an increase in our individual audiences, which roll up to a bigger increase for the industry overall.
So what exactly are you expecting we, the podcast community, to do? I kind of know the answer to this question because I've been doing it, but for those who are listening and those others out there who do podcasts, what do you want them to do?
It's a great question. Thank you for asking. It's really very, very simple. Think of a podcast that you love and think of a podcast that someone you care about would love. We want you to go tell that person about the podcast you think they would really like. And if they don't know how to use podcasts, if they're confused about how to find podcasts on their mobile device, show them how to listen to podcasts. And once you're done making this great introduction, this great connection, go on to social media. Twitter seems to be where most of this activity is happening, but any social media platform, Facebook, Instagram, whatever you use is fantastic. And tell the universe that you've done this great thing, that you've made a connection, you've introduced to someone to something new that they love, and use the hashtag tripod when you do it, TRYPOD. And as this builds momentum, your recommendations are seen by other people looking for recommendations, and something you may feel really good about and really excited about, or your friend might feel really excited about, now gets even more exposure and gets discovered by somebody who might also fall in love with it.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, what podcast do you listen to?
You know, I listen to a fairly narrow range for someone who works in broadcasting. I'm still very much a terrestrial listening guy, but things that are on my go-to list each and every week include a program that we proudly distribute called Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, which is a pop culture interview show that's pretty fantastic. For a music podcast, I listen to a program called LPR Live, which stands for La Poussin Rouge Live, which is a great eclectic and progressive nightclub in New York. They do modern classical music, which I'm a big fan of, so LPR Live. What else is at the top of my list every week? I'm a big fan of Pop Culture Happy Hour, which is also another NPR show, and I'm late to the train, but apparently everyone is super excited about Finding Richard Simmons, so I got to start listening to that. That's next up on my list.
Okay, I hope you put that out there with the hashtag tripod yourself.
Every darn day, adding to the list.
Excellent. Israel, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. Again, we are urging people to go online on social media and use the hashtag tripod, TRYPOD, to accent and highlight the various podcasts that they listen to, share it with the rest of the world. And as you said earlier, you're hoping that the tide raises everybody.
That's exactly right. Peter, I so appreciate the interest. It's been great to talk to you and be a part of your program.
Thanks for being on the program with me, sir.
Take good care.
Israel Smith, the Senior Director of Promotion and Audience Development at NPR. He's the mastermind behind the month-long campaign for podcast awareness. Again, go on social media and share the shows you listen to with the hashtag TryPod. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this show, which is 0395, and you'll find links to learn more about the campaign. And since you just heard Israel share some of the podcasts that he likes to listen to, let me share some of mine. Every Friday with Dan and Olivia, featuring Dan Miles and Olivia Dabo, it's just fun chatter. It's like having a drink or coffee with a couple of good friends. The Spoon with Robbie Rist, Tom Bowers, and Chris Jackson. Three irreverent, eclectic guys who debate whatever comes to their mind. There's also Stuff You Should Know. That's a fun, informative podcast. The Kelly Alexander Show features great interviews and tips from a woman's perspective. The Herd with Colin Cowherd for you sports fans. And the Sound Off Podcast with Matt Kundle. It's a podcast about podcasting, a very fitting show for this campaign. It features a lot of radio pros sharing tips and stories. So, those are just a few. What's your list? Share them online and get the podcast word out there. Again, remember, use the hashtag tripod. That's TRYPOD. Hashtag tripod.
A message from the American Podcast Council.
You and I know why podcasting is so wonderful, but in a recent survey, 45% of Americans indicated they're unaware of the term podcasting. Think about it. 45%. People just like you, living unaware. It's as if the term podcasting was just a word, like Folgenblurble, or Mockingturf, or Schleen. People in your community need help. All this month, we want you to find a friend, a relative, a curious stranger. Show them how to try podcasts. Then share your story on something called Twitter with the hashtag tripod. That's TRY pod. Together we can delete podcast unawareness. Won't you help? That's TRY Pod.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Imagine your doctor has just told you that you have a fatal disease and you have only months to live. There are no treatments approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration, but there is a new therapy that could save your life. Unfortunately, the FDA's rigid clinical testing requirements means it'll be a decade or more before the new drug is available to you. Every year, thousands of people find themselves in this terrible situation. They're willing to try experimental treatments, but the FDA's red tape prevents them from doing so. To address this problem, 31 states have enacted laws called Right to Try that let terminally ill patients try promising treatments that have passed the first phase of the FDA's clinical tests. Let's be fair, that's a good start, but terminally ill patients need federal action. Vice President Pence signed a Right to Try law as governor of Indiana, and now the White House says it's time for Congress to act too. For thousands of patients, it can't happen soon enough. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do indeed have Stuart Nauman with us with another edition of Book Banter, and it's a crock, I say. It's all a crock.
Yeah, but Peter, it's the K-R-O-C kind of crock.
Oh, okay.
Okay, not the other kind.
Ah.
And I hope you've eaten dinner, because you may get hungry if you haven't. Because in this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at Ray Kroc and the McDonald's, the fast food chain that he built up into an empire. You know, that story is part of American business lore. You know, that fateful day in 1954 when Ray Kroc, he was a 52-year-old mixmaster salesman. He paid a visit to a San Bernardino, California hamburger stand to find out why its proprietors, brothers Mac and Dick McDonald, bought not just one, but several of these Mixmasters and were asking for even more. And what he found out was a revolutionary way to prepare and serve hamburgers, fries, and milkshakes from the kitchen to the customer in just 30 seconds, and was attracting a steady flock of customers every day. It was a new food service phenomenon called fast food, and Ray Kroc wanted a part of it. So the following year, he opened up his first restaurant under the McDonald's Golden Arches in a Chicago suburb, using the McDonald brothers' high standards for food preparation and restaurant cleanliness. And more than 60 years later, those Golden Arches have sold billions of hamburgers around the world, and its trademark sandwiches like the Big Mac, Quarter Pounder, Egg McMuffin, and yes, even the McRib, and they have become a major part of popular culture ever since. Now, the story of Ray Kroc and how he turned this hamburger stand into a major American gastronomic business success is indeed a fascinating one, and was even subject of a major motion picture biopic that was released earlier this year called The Founder, which starred Michael Keaton as Kroc. Now, the movie, in turn, was in part based on Kroc's 1977 memoir, Grinding It Out, which has been reissued, actually, in paperback to coincide with the release of The Founder. Now, the book, which offered the first behind-the-scenes account of the history of McDonald's, is a story of how Kroc did indeed grind it out to become a business success, and through a lot of grit, determination, and hard work, he made a success for himself no matter what venture he undertook. Now, while the first half of this book is basically echoes the story that is told in The Founder, Kroc offers plenty of behind-the-arches stories to what made McDonald's such a phenomenal success, although it wasn't always the case during its formative years throughout the 50s and early 60s. You know, he duly credits some of the people that worked closely with him at his Chicago-based head office that helped plant the seeds of McDonald's success as a chain of fast food restaurants, like Harry Sonneborn, who urged Kroc to be more of a landlord and rent the land to franchisees that would, use the site for these sites for their future restaurants. Then there's those franchisees who convinced Kroc to introduce new sandwiches to the McDonald's menu, like the Cincinnati franchisee who introduced the first non-hamburger sandwich called the Filet-O-Fish back in the 60s. And then there's the rather bizarre yet funny moment in 1974 during the home opener for the San Diego Padres shortly after Kroc bought the team, in which he took to the microphone early in the game after the Padres were turning in a rather less than stellar performance on the field and went on an angry tirade in which he not only tore a strip off the team, but he also apologized to the fans for the poor spectacle they were witnessing.
Yes. Warmth. That's what he had. Warmth.
maybe the only warmth that was being provided was those heat lamps warming up those French fries, I guess.
You know, between him and I was going to bring up the idea that he owned the Padres for a period of time, and between him and George Steinbrenner and Charlie O'Finley, boy, there were some really short-tempered owners around, weren't there?
Oh yeah, and don't forget Marge Sharp from the Cincinnati Reds.
Well, she came later though.
Yeah,
she came later. She was a whole different breed all to herself.
Hey, look, and if the team didn't work out, you know, Kroc can go back to hamburgers.
Yeah.
At the very least. But grinding out is still quite an entertaining business book about an enterprising individual who worked hard and paid his dues as he used those old-fashioned principles that made him a success in the past, even when he was selling paper cups during the Depression, as he created an empire built on burgers.
Hmm. So the book is entitled
Grinding It Out, The Making of McDonald's by the late Ray Kroc. It's published by St. Martin's Griffin, which is the paperback division of St. Martin's Press, and it's $22.99.
And you did refer to him as the late Ray Kroc. We just want to make it perfectly clear to the listening audience that he did indeed write this before he died.
Yes, well, you know, it was published in 1977, and he passed away in 1984.
Yes, just want to make sure people are clear on the fact that he didn't do this book from the grave.
No. You know, that's why they have ghost writers, right?
Exactly. What other books in this genre do you recommend, sir?
Well, if you want to read more about McDonald's, a more unflinching account and a more thorough account of the history of the franchise is well told in a terrific book called McDonald's Behind the Arches by John Love. And if you want to read another successful businessman story, there's a recent bestseller that came out last year called Shoe Dog by Phil Knight. And you want to find out, you know, about the story behind the Nike empire and how he just did it.
Absolutely. And again, this week's book again is
called Grinding It Out, The Making of McDonald's by the late Ray Kroc. It's published by St. Martin's Griffin, and it's $22.99 in trade paperback.
You keep saying late like you think he might return.
Well, who knows? The specter of Ray Kroc probably hangs over every golden arch around the world.
And how can people find you, the very alive Stuart Nolman?
Well, I'm not munching away on my McChicken sandwich at McDonald's. You can find me every week in the Montreal Times in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu. Go ahead. You deserve a break today.
Yeah, so come on and get away to McDonald's.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now. And there is an Idiot of the Day coming your way, so stick around for that. And remember, this show is also on Patreon.com. It's fan-funded, listener-supported. Become a patron. We'd appreciate it. Daniel Hawkins was in a Las Vegas, Nevada alley at night when two men came up to him and, he says, tried to rob him. Hawkins identified himself as a police detective and was working an undercover stakeout. One of the robbers was holding a gun and he pointed it at the ground. As he pulled it up to aim at Hawkins, Hawkins pulled his own gun and shot him. The man survived. His accomplice got away. 48-year-old Thomas L. Cotton has 112 prior arrests and 11, count them, 11 felony convictions, including for robbery. But the gun he pulled was fake. Well, fake or not, how is someone with 112 prior arrests and 11 felony convictions even walking the streets? Shouldn't he be a guest of the state indefinitely? Meanwhile, when disaster strikes, well-meaning people are beseeched to help, but relief workers seem always bogged down with wholly inappropriate donations, which take additional time and money to sort and store and discard. That's why, instead, all such charities recommend cash. A January report by Australia's principal relief organization praised Aussies' generosity in spite of recent contributions of high heels, handbags, chainsaws, sports gear, wool clothing, and canned goods, much of which will eventually go into landfills. Workers in Rwanda reportedly received prom gowns, wigs, tiger costumes, pumpkins, and frostbite cream. In Rwanda. Yes, I know it's better to give than to receive, but sometimes you really need to consider what it is you're giving. A Pennsylvania man has been convicted of failing to file his income tax returns for 21 years because he considered using a Social Security number akin to using the mark of the beast, spelled out in the Bible. 59-year-old James Slosser, who lives in the town of Bird in Hand, was convicted in federal court in Allentown. Prosecutors say by failing to file the returns from 1994 to 2014, he didn't report $2.3 million in income that he earned as a salesman of medical equipment. Prosecutors say he funneled the money through foreign business trusts and corporations he registered in Nevada. He'll be sentenced June 10th when he faces a maximum of 5 years in prison and $450 in fines. So, he went all biblical with his explanation, huh? And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. Well, that's a revelation. As you know, everything happens at Walmart. Here's just the latest example. Brooksville, Florida police arrested a man they say was swinging swords at customers in Walmart on Broad Street. The responding officers were called by the store's manager, who said someone was threatening customers in the parking lot. When they got there, they found Shannon Schenck carrying 2 swords and appearing to be under the influence of drugs or alcohol. Several witnesses told officers Schenck had assumed a fighting stance and unsheathed the swords in a threatening manner while approaching customers exiting their vehicles. Officers also found less than 20 grams of marijuana on Schenck, as well as a glass pipe with marijuana residue. Okay, he must have also had been on some other kind of drug, because doesn't grass usually mellow people out? From what I hear, anyway. And if that is the case, and he's only on weed, just how high-strung was he before he toked up? Yee. Anyway, boys and girls, you know what time it is. Yes, it's the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
Definition of Sears sucker? A sucker who tries to steal at Sears. 32-year-old Alfonso Tony Whitelaw, who'd just been sentenced in a theft case, was busted for shoplifting hours later after forgetting his court papers at a Minnesota store. Employees at a Sears store in St. Paul saw Whitelaw sneak into the dressing room with an armful of clothing on February 21st and exit with the allegedly stolen apparel stuffed under his own clothes. When a worker tried to stop him, Whitelaw allegedly pulled out a knife. "Don't touch me," he hissed, according to the criminal complaint. Whitelaw took off, but police tracked him down after workers found his sentencing paperwork in the dressing room. The paper showed that same morning he'd received a stayed sentence on misdemeanor theft charges out of Dakota County District Court. He also left behind a love letter for his wife that promised that he'd, quote, put a ring on her finger, the complainant said. Whitelaw's criminal record includes convictions for theft, making terroristic threats, possession of a controlled substance, fleeing police, domestic assault, and check forgery. In his latest shoplifting case, he was charged with aggravated robbery and assault. Now, why, oh why, would you leave so much damaging evidence in a Sears dressing room when you're trying to shoplift a whole new wardrobe? Well, one reason is you truly are a Sears sucker, and the other reason is you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0395. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0395. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on Patreon, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of... Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.